Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, July 2nd, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Amanda Hinnett and Jim Flink. On our program this week, the Associated Press announces it's going to use robots to write certain business stories, saying it can't afford to have people spending too much time doing data processing. Was Matt Lauer out of line when he asked General Motors CEO Mary Barra if she got the job because she's a woman and whether she thinks she's able to balance being a mother with running the billion-dollar company? And we'll talk about Facebook's study of users' emotional states as determined through manipulations to the news feed. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with something that's developed just southwest of here, down in Waynesville. On Monday, the first ever gay pride event was held on post at Fort Leonard Wood. Command Sergeant Major Teresa King spoke at a luncheon about her journey coming out and living openly as a gay soldier in the U.S. Army. Some would say that's news. It's not that long ago such an event held on a military post would have been illegal. Others would say, though, that there are diversity events held all the time, celebrating one group or another, and as a result, this one didn't deserve any more attention than any other. We're about to get into the weeds talking about some of what went on there, but I want to start by asking, would you both consider this to have been a newsworthy event, something to cover?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. This was a first-of-a-kind event. It was happening, as you mentioned, on a military base. So, you know, in any newsroom, what you're doing is you're looking at all of the stories that you have to cover in a day. This one would rise, particularly if that were in my direct geographical area, to a pretty high level.
I completely agree. It's a first of its kind. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed only a couple, three years ago. And precisely because this is not in San Francisco makes it newsworthy.
Okay, well then we're going to go ahead and talk a little bit more in detail now that we, I think, are all in agreement. We each would have sent a reporter, sent a crew, gone forward and covered that. Let me tell you about a situation that developed for one Pulaski County newspaper publisher and caught the attention of the regional and national press. Daryl Todd Marina is the publisher of the Pulaski County Daily News. He covers stories of interest to people in and around Waynesville, both on post and off. And last week, a question posed to him by an aspiring journalist who identifies as lesbian about whether he'd cover the gay pride event at Fort Leonard Wood turned into, well, a thing. That's because of this public Facebook response to the inquiry, which says, promoting gay pride in Pulaski County, this isn't San Francisco. The post caught the attention of many. Nearly 1,200 commented. Stories appeared in several gay press websites and in the Riverfront Times, a St. Louis-based blog. Marina told me via Facebook chat yesterday that on the face of it, he didn't think the event warranted coverage. There wasn't going to be any kind of debate of any policy. It was going to be a gathering of like-minded people sharing lunch with a keynote speaker. And he didn't want to be seen as promoting a gay pride event that he didn't think his readership would be receptive or responsive to it. With Marina's permission, I have shared that Facebook chat with both of you, with Amanda and with Jim, and you've had a chance to look through it. Having said that, having heard a little bit more of his side of the story, is this a miscommunication between two people that blew up on Facebook, or is it something more?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, you know, I think you have to be mindful that when you're sharing information, you're having a conversation on social media, that is not a private conversation, and it's probably never going to be a private conversation. So I think that that very much is the case. I think the other thing is that I don't think he expected that this social media post was going to blow up in the way that it did. And at least in looking at the transcript of the conversation that you had, that you did share with us with his permission, it seemed to me that he was backtracking a little bit. I will say this. In that conversation, he made some very good points about what is applicable to his readership. I think that news does vary a bit on a weekly, newspaper versus a daily, based on your staffing, based on what's going on, based a bit on your audience. That having been said, he had an opportunity here to really enlighten his audience that is very close to this military base on an issue that is of national import, and he had an opportunity to bring that to his local paper and to his local readership in a way that informed and educated, and I think he missed that opportunity.
And also, this didn't have to be a big piece. I mean, the point being that, you know, there was no debate. It was more of like a press kind of situation. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that would prohibit 200, 300 words. Moreover, when has a newspaper man ever shied away from controversy? Isn't that like a core news value? If you're going to get people's blood pressure up, isn't that a good thing and make people aware of what's going on, even if they disagree with it?
Well, I would agree with that right there. His whole point was, at least as I interpreted it, that he didn't think his readers would want to or be interested in reading it. Therefore, he wasn't going to initially make a big deal out of covering it. He did end up going to the event on Monday. But I think part of the question that I would ask is, and Jim, you started to touch on this, sometimes as journalists and as gatekeepers, do we have a responsibility to make sure that there's an even balance of news diet there? Maybe the idea of sometimes spinach or Brussels sprouts don't taste good, but there's a place for that within the product we provide to our readers, our listeners, and our viewers.
Absolutely. That's our role in the democracy, is to tell people what is going on, to inform them so that they can make, you know, good decisions in their lives. Now, the other question is, and he brought this up, is mm-hmm. were other media there? Are other media being held accountable in the same way he is and his paper is? I think with the Facebook discussion, he brought the attention to himself. And with that sort of inflammatory post about San Francisco, he brought it to his door. And his point of, I'm going to see if there are other people covering this, and then I'll decide, that to me, it kind of made me question his editorial gut. If you're just going to look around and see if anyone else is doing it and that's how you decide, that's a problem to me.
That being said, yeah, I mean, I think the question does have to be asked, did the television stations that were within reach also see this as the opportunity to cover a first-of-its-kind event? And I think this is a problem that a lot of newsrooms make, is that they don't understand the ramifications of a story such as this and how it might impact their viewership, their usership, whatever you want to call it. And so I agree with Amanda that it was the social media post that took this over and above, not just the fact that he did or did not cover.
Well, and by all indications, that area in Pulaski County is part of both the mid-Missouri television market that we're in here with KWMU, KMIZ, and KRCG, and also down in Springfield. And by all indications, it appears none of the six television stations that serve those areas were there.
So everybody missed that story.
Everybody missed that story.
And whether they did it deliberately or not, we don't know.
Right.
Because it didn't post on Facebook about
right.
that decision.
Okay. Well, this past weekend, there were pride parades all across the country, documentaries on TV about gay marriage, all over the place, positive images from gay communities across America, everywhere but on CNBC. The gaffe came during a discussion with New York Times columnist and CNBC contributor Jim Stewart, who was on to talk about his latest piece dealing with corporate culture and gay executives. Take a listen for when CNBC co-anchor Simon Hobbs chimes in.
There are gay CEOs of major companies, and I reached out to many of them, and I have to say I got an extremely cool reception. Not one would allow to be named
in
the
column. Well, I think Tim Cook is fairly open about the fact that he's gay at the head of Apple, isn't he?
No.
Oh, dear. Was that an error?
Wow.
I don't know. I thought not.
I think you just, yeah.
I think he's very open about it.
The New York Times tried very hard to bring that to the fore in the recent story.
I don't want to comment about anybody who might or might not be, because I'm not going to out anybody, and I called a lot of people, and no one at any major company would allow their names to be used.
The awkwardness in that moment was palpable. We've talked about the danger of outing people on this program before and how that can be a horrible situation when that happens in a story. We saw that in a Grantland piece about 6 months ago that was linked to the suicide of a transgender woman. This is a bell you can't unring.
No. And it's really unfortunate, because when sometimes when you're in broadcast for a while, I think you get too comfortable with being on camera. And I think you forget that the camera is there, and you start to have conversations with people that you have every day in a way that you might do in the break room or whatever. And And in this moment, you do it. Now, that having been said, it would be great if in this day and age, and I know you'll want to weigh on this too, that this didn't matter, mm-hmm. that this wasn't even a discussion that made headlines, that there was no outing or not outing, that people felt comfortable. That isn't the case, clearly, yet.
Yes, and like you said, the idea of being comfortable on air, this struck me as like cocktail party chatter, which really should not matter about the financial performance of this person's company. And when it's done on air, it feels like a witch hunt, which I agree would be much better if it weren't the case. But you cannot go into somebody's personal life without them bringing it up.
So there is an interesting piece that our audience can take a look at on our links blog under the talk shows tab at kbia.org. When can you ask a public figure about their sexual orientation? Is there ever a time when that matters or is relevant?
If you're talking about whether somebody can lead a company, or in the case that we're going to talk about with the Matt Lauer situation, mm-hmm. Whether they're capable of, you know, dealing with a crisis, I don't think their personal lives matter. They would have to bring that up in order for it to be relevant.
And to answer the question more specifically, when it becomes a part of the news process, when there are other contributing factors that make that element now more newsworthy, mm-hmm. something happens in some way, shape, or form that now elevates that part of their profile to a more newsworthy status, then you start to talk about it. Until then, it really shouldn't be relevant to anything.
How many times have you been working and had a thought or two about what you're doing being so mundane that a robot could do it, that your efforts could be focused on doing something more meaningful? Well, that's what editors are thinking about at the Associated Press, that there are better ways for their business reporters to be spending their time than writing up quarterly earnings stories. Managing editor Lou Ferreira says automating these data-heavy stories will let the cooperative move as many as 4,400 stories a quarter. That would be more than 300 more than they had in the previous quarter. He says once humans stop spending their time crunching the numbers, they can devote more of their time to finding ways to make those numbers more meaningful to you, the reader. This isn't the first time that we're seeing this. We've started to see it a lot with sports stories, that box scores are being analyzed by computer and automatically turning out a narrative. But it seems a little easier to do that with sports than maybe in a business story. There's sometimes some nuances that can be found there in numbers that a computer might miss.
Well, the real question for me is, it will be properly labeled as generated by a machine, which mm-hmm. I think that the person who released this said, and they weren't going to be firing journalists over it. And the idea really was to free up their time to work on other stories. Whether that will be true is the question.
Well, I think there are a couple of things about this. One is, it's pretty obvious when a computer generates a story, because there are all sorts of things that you go, wow, that doesn't seem like a person wrote that. And so I would say, first of all, I don't think journalists are necessarily in jeopardy as a result of this development. I do believe that scalable journalism is changing the way that we do business. And I think this is very much addressing this part that we used to talk about, things like broadcasting or mass media. We used to talk about mass consumption of media. Now we're talking about individual consumption of media. And for each one of us, we're consuming it in our own way, in our own time, with our own attention spans. And I think what this does is it helps to fill in some of the void that is naturally happening in the marketplace. I don't have a problem with this. I think this is really good, because I do think that it's going to allow us to get into some better journalism and to allocate our resources to people to do more analysis and more coverage and not just do this number crunching. I think it's good.
So how do we make sure then, as journalists, as the watchdogs, mm-hmm. that as some of these stories are being automated, that we don't let another Enron or another WorldCom go right past us, because maybe a computer doesn't spot some of those irregularities in the same way that a person would and raise an eyebrow and dig a little bit deeper?
Well, I don't think this is Autobot. I mean, I don't think this is just let the computer crank out whatever it cranks out and don't pay attention or mind the story. I think this is about saying, you're still looking at those numbers. You're still evaluating mm-hmm. all of this. But what you're doing is you're not having to do the tedium work that sometimes does allow you to catch those, by the way.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you're still minding the store.
Okay, so starting with sports, now business. Any predictions on what area of journalism might go next in terms of the way of automation?
This all feels like deja vu to me. When I woke up to that headline, I was like, I feel like I read this story 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I just don't know if it's the biggest deal.
I don't know that it's the biggest deal either. I think we'll see it in a lot of different areas. It might be in anything where there is some predictable sort of formula to the story, I think you'll see it develop.
A Florida judge threw out George Zimmerman's libel suit against NBC on Monday. According to the Orlando Sentinel, Judge Deborah S. Nelson said there was no clear evidence anyone at NBC knew the information it published was false at the time or that it recklessly disregarded the truth of the statements. The tape in question aired on the Today Show and had Zimmerman saying, "This guy is up to no good. He looks black." The tape was edited with several seconds removed, which would have provided context, including a dispatcher asking for a racial description. So NBC won this one in court, but we do know that three employees at NBC lost their jobs over it. So what we're kind of seeing here is what's legal may not be ethical.
Right. And this is a lesson that we all, especially broadcasters, have to continue to revisit. You know, spending 20 years in a television newsroom, we are looking for the money soundbite. We are looking for the thing that really will catch viewers' attention, will sort of sum up the story in one neat little 6 or 7 second soundbite. Problem with that is that when you start to not look at the rest of the material or put it into context, now you get into some trouble. Ethical, legal, I mean, no actual malice here, but the reason that those reporters were let go presumably would be because they weren't paying attention to the full body of their work and looking at it in larger sense.
And deliberately misrepresenting what happened.
There you go.
And you could easily do this in print too, where you cut off parts of quotes and have ellipses, you know, where there are words that were said, you know, so this happens in all forms of journalism, cutting down of quotes. Now, to the point where you're cutting of quotes misrepresents what happens, that's when you have an ethical problem.
When you have the ellipses though in print, doesn't that almost right away have an indication there's something here that has been omitted? Yes, it could material, it could change that quote in a material sense, but when it's done with audio, you don't know that something has been removed there. There is no kind of visual cue to the level at which something has been changed or manipulated.
Absolutely. But again, that's probably a little bit of insider baseball that we think ellipses mean this.
Okay.
Does everyone who reads that story think that or know that?
I think the other thing is that broadcasters in particular now have other means by which to give context. And it's called .com or it's called a news app or whatever, where you can say, you want to see the full transcript? Mm-hmm. You want to hear the full audio tape? We're going to provide that to you in a way that we can't do over the air because we only have a minute and a half or whatever. And so broadcasters in particular need to avail themselves of the opportunity to give context wherever possible, especially on a story like this.
So some more missteps at the Today Show, or maybe not. Let's talk about Matt Lauer's interview with General Motors CEO Mary Barra. The two sat down in Detroit Thursday for a live interview, primarily focusing on GM's response to safety issues. Lauer wrapped up the two-part discussion this way.
You've heard this. You heard it in Congress, and you've heard it in the headlines. You got this job because you are hugely qualified. 30 years in this company, a variety of different jobs. But there are some people who are speculating that you also got this job as a woman and as a mom because people within General Motors knew this company was in for a very tough time. And as a woman and a mom, you could prevent a softer face and softer image for this company as it goes through this horrible episode. Does it make sense or does it make you bristle?
Well, it's absolutely not true. I believe I was selected for this job based on my qualifications.
That struck a nerve with many as sexist. No small issue for the host of a network program in which most of the audience is women. Lauer says he has no regrets about the question and says it's an issue for working parents regardless of gender, adding that it applied to him as well, that he went to Detroit to do that interview, missing his son's 13th birthday. You're both working parents. Jim, you're a working dad. Amanda, a working mom. If I were to ask each of you that same question, would it be an equal question to both of you?
Well, the point is, would you ask both of
us? No, I wouldn't ask you that question.
And would Matt Lauer ask a male CEO that question? Obviously, that is the main thing here. I think what we're not paying attention to is Matt Lauer just throwing a grenade into the mommy wars for ratings. I mean, is that what this is really about, to generate conversation about the Today Show?
You know, I think it's maybe I think it's a little bit less sinister than that, although I do think it's the classic. Some people say, and I've got to ask you the hardball question, so I'm going to go with the some people say that it's this. And, you know, it's kind of lame. Either ask the question and say, I want to ask you this because I think that this is central to why you got hired. And just own it. And then take the flag for it. But don't do that some people say.
Or the, we're going to tread lightly here. I'm going to tread lightly in asking you this.
Right. Why not say, you know, I wouldn't ask a male CEO this question, but we have a double standard for female CEOs, and therefore I'm going to ask you.
That would have been better.
Yeah,
because,
I mean,
because
totally
that's exactly right. You would never ask me that because we assume that fathers go to work and achieve CEO status. We don't assume that happens. We should. We don't necessarily assume. Some in the audience, Matt Lauer, doesn't assume that, and that is faulty thinking.
Congratulations. If you're on Facebook, chances are you can add Lab Rat to the many titles that you already hold. That's because we found out late Friday that Facebook conducted a scientific study in which it experimented with users' moods by manipulating some posts in the newsfeed. For 1 week in January 2012, data scientists skewed what they say is almost 700,000 Facebook users saw when they logged into the service. In some cases, feeds were peppered with happy, positive words. Others had sadder than average content appear. At the end of the week, people who saw positive messages tended to use more positive language in their posts. Those who had negative messages appear used more negative language. It's often said when a product is free, you are the product. So does word of this experiment come as a surprise to you?
What comes as a surprise to me is that this was published in the academic press in a peer-reviewed journal, because that is where the difference lies in how we do research and whether the IRB needs to approve it.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. Uh-huh. We have a familiarity with the IRB as people who do research here with human subjects at the university. Can you describe for our audience what the IRB is and how it works?
Of course. First of all, the IRB stands for Institutional Review Board. Okay. It is designed to protect human subjects from experiencing some sort of risk they wouldn't normally experience, and to keep, you know, deviant researchers like myself, or DVS, devious researchers like myself from, you know, putting them at risk. So it's designed to protect the subjects. It is also designed to protect the university from litigation. The whole thing is set up so that we avoid risk. We avoid putting people in bad situations, such as where we manipulate their emotional states without them knowing it.
Okay.
So, however, companies... And this is if you want to publish in a peer-reviewed journal or send it to a peer-reviewed conference, okay? Companies like Facebook, they can do proprietary company research all the time. They don't have
to get... And likely do.
They are doing these experiments all the time. The difference is that it's proprietary. It doesn't get published anywhere. We never find out about it. So the fact that this made it into PNAS, this big journal, and that they collaborated with two academic researchers.
Somebody from Cornell University and University of California, San Francisco.
Right. That's what makes this different. So in some ways I would say, you know, this is unethical based on our academic standards for IRB for many reasons. It's unethical because they didn't, you know, set out the IRB so it was easy to find. It was just sort of buried in the 10 pages terms of service, right? That's one reason why it was unethical. Another reason is they didn't debrief them at the end saying, hey, we just messed with your feed. Do you feel okay? You know, and that's what you have to do as a responsible researcher. Now, taking another tactic, I would say this is valuable because otherwise we don't have access to any of that data and Facebook can just use it for their own gain. So it's kind of like, well, would we rather know that this is happening and have it published in a place that we can all access it and people can analyze it? Does that make sense?
It does.
You know, here's the thing that I would think is the takeaway from me as a social media user and particularly a Facebook user is that someone is always watching, someone is always paying attention, and someone is always evaluating, gauging, assessing, in some way adding value or a value judgment to what it is that I'm doing, with the idea that either they're going to make money on it, they're going to learn more from it, but that this is not a private experience. And, you know, the more we say it, the less it seems to resonate. Using social media is not a private experience. It is not something you're doing in private. And even having the presumption that it is probably is a little bit naive. That having been said, everything that Amanda just said about what researchers should do stands, right? Mm-hmm.
So there has been some pressure on the journal that published it to pull the study, to retract it. Is that something that happens, or is that kind of the social media world reacting and saying, you did something we don't like, so take it back?
Well, I was sort of trying to follow the trail of where they talk about informed consent, and I actually went to the article to read it. And basically, Facebook contends that they had informed consent. Somebody else posted that they started the emotional manipulation before they had that in the terms of service. And so, in fact, they don't have informed consent. So it's not – this is not Facebook's problem. This is Cornell's problem. This is UC San Francisco. Their problem. I would be very worried if I were those researchers or those institutions, because they basically waived their informed consent process and said, Facebook took care of this. And now that opens them up to attack. So that's where I would be concerned. I know that sounds like, again, a lot of sort of like insider stuff, but really it hurts the credibility of the researchers at those institutions, because everyone's going to think, well, you don't care about my emotional state. You're just going to, when you get access to all this data — now don't get me wrong, I'd love to have access to all of this data — when you get access to this, you're just going to waive your process. That's where the questions are. And there's a little bit of passing the buck happening there.
Okay. Finally today, I want to talk about a practice that is pretty common, I think, in television news, the rip and read. The idea a story is done well, either because the journalism is breaking new ground or has some kind of oh wow factor, and other news outlets pick up on it. In television news, affiliates share stories via feeds on an hourly basis, and we're reminded of it every time Conan O'Brien runs another one of those segments showing news anchors across the country reading the exact same script, never changing a word. But most of those times, anchors toss to the exact same recorded package that they air exactly as it was given to them by the network. What happens, though, when an affiliate station takes the work of a reporter in one market and repackages it as their own? Is it plagiarism or simply standard operating procedure? George Warren wants to know. See, that's because the KXTV reporter saw and heard his words voiced by someone else on a New York City television broadcast.
Caught on camera, lightning strike in the middle of a camping site inside Yellowstone National Park.
The man holding the camera had no idea. He was just a couple of feet away from where it hit. CBS 2's Lonnie Quinn now with more of this incredible video and how it happened.
Get ready. Here it comes. You saw it. I saw it. But amazingly, the guy who shot the video didn't see it.
There was no sense of a flash. We just knew it was very close, and it was only when we reviewed the video that we saw just how close it was.
Bruce Hyland was camping with a group of friends at Shoshone Lake in Yellowstone National Park, and he pulled out his camera to take pictures of this sudden hailstorm.
All of a sudden, we hear this enormous crash. We didn't see a flash of lightning. We didn't know how near it was. But I just thought, well, hey, I've been taking a video. I wonder if I caught the thunderclap when it went off.
You saw it, I saw it. Well, in all honesty, none of us saw it, including the reporter that we heard there voicing that.
Right. TV stations are doing this. They're doing it more and more as a way to showcase their talent and to get more localized content into the newscast, including using their anchors in particular. This ought to cause everybody to rethink that process.
Would it have been different had WCBS run the original package written and voiced by Warren and simply tossed to by one of their folks?
I don't know that it would have been materially different. It's, again, about showcasing your local talent, but I don't think it really achieves the objective.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time for today. Thanks for joining us. You can read more about the topics we talked about on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Hope Kerwin is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next time when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.